The hour 10:15 have arrived. We will call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. We have Johnson Bill S. We have Representative Thiessen's bill. Let's go with Grunhagen. You're the, Thiessen's here. But you have somebody that has to leave right away? Okay, let's go. Is that okay, Representative Thiessen? Okay. This shouldn't take too long. Then we'll go to Representative Thiessen. Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could, and we're not, we haven't officially convened yet, but we will start with testimony here. First of all, on, we're looking at Representative Grunhagen will move when we have a quorum, House File 156. We've had this bill before in past years, but we will give it a full hearing here, of course. Is there anyone wishes to testify on behalf of the bill other than the witness at the table? Anyone with concerns? Department? Wish, okay, make comments on this. Okay. To your bill. And when we get a quorum, we'll officially, you will officially move the bill up to Grunhagen, House File 156. Please proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. What House File 156 does, it allows a state income tax subtraction for medical professionals, and they're listed in the bill, for charity care. In other words, on a voluntary basis, helping someone with a health problem. I have several personal experiences I can share in that area, but I'll wait for my closing comment. You know, it's long been a goal of mine, and I think of the insurance industry as general, to create an equal playing field in the tax area for both group insurance, which enjoys a lot of tax benefits, and also individual health insurance. This bill also allows qualifying out-of-pocket medical expenses to be state tax deducted, similar to the advantage that you can have on group insurance. With the skyrocketing deductibles and premiums, this is one more way to help people, albeit at the end of a tax year, to get some relief from those high costs, both the premiums and out-of-pocket deductible. Oh, this is charity care.
Right.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. I have another bill that'll be up that it was late last night. Okay.
Why don't we talk about 156?
Yeah, why don't we talk about 156?
The other one was sounding very good, too.
Yeah. And hopefully it's a bill that'll
now
be
up. Now you have your hearing on that other one.
How about if we start all over? You gavel me in it. No, okay. We're not going from there. We're just doing the charity care.
To 156.
Yep. So basically it allows medical professionals to have a state tax deduction and to incentivize them to give charity care. I think we know that, you know, whether we see charitable tax deductions, we incentivize them for the public good, both state and federal tax deductions. So when you give a tax deduction, it does, you do increase the amount of that particular service, and in this case being charity care for people with health problems. I have Dave Renner from the MMA to provide additional testimony.
Please state your name for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner, and I want to correct your agenda with the Minnesota Medical Association, not the Middle Management Association. Even though a lot of our physician members would feel as if they are in middle management these days.
But, we'll just call it the MMA.
Thank you very much.
And excuse me, we do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Now, Representative Grunhagen moves House File 156. Representative Grunhagen moves the H015684 amendment. That's your amendment?
Correct.
Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment has been adopted to House File 156. Representative Schultz, do we have any minutes here? Representative Schultz moves the minutes of February 9th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Okay, to the bill as amended, Mr. Renner from the Minnesota Medical Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. And I want to thank you and Representative Grunhagen for his work on House File 156. As I think many of you know, Minnesota leads the nation or is among the lowest uninsured rates in the country at 4.3%. And we think that's because we have a strong commitment of employers, but also a strong public safety net program. But despite that, we still have an estimated 234,000 Minnesotans without insurance, and even more with high deductibles and under insurance. Minnesota physicians continue to show their commitment to serve these folks, regardless of their ability to pay. And what Representative Grunhagen is attempting to do in House File 156 is to provide some kind of incentive to continue to do at least what's referred to as charity care. And when you look at uncompensated care, and in the fiscal note talks about some of these numbers of the physician services, the estimates about $91.4 million of charity care is provided, at least among the physician services, and this bill deals with more than just physicians. And this would be one small attempt to say thank you, in a sense, and provide an incentive for physicians and other healthcare providers to continue to provide that care. We think we strongly support our safety net programs. We want to continue to encourage people to get full coverage and full insurance, but this is another way to help encourage that we treat the underserved. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Renner at this point? Let's go to the department. Thank you, Mr. Renner. I thought you had a new job. It looked like.
Morning.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
I did call Representative Grunhagen's office about this bill, and I know that we have spoken in the past about the important public policy goals that are hoped to achieve through this method. The bill creates a new subtraction for the value of charitable health care services provided by a taxpayer who is a medical professional, dentist, or chiropractor. The taxpayer or the employer of the taxpayer must file an informational report with the commissioner documenting the value of the services provided. The amount of the subtraction is based on the value of services calculated under the rate provided in 256B.76. The Department of Revenue has no experience in calculating the rates for medical reimbursement, but based on Minnesota Statutes 256B.76, it is a very complex formula and would require the Department of Revenue to obtain staff with the appropriate knowledge and experience with this computation to verify the validity of subtractions claimed. Federally, Mr. Chair, the value of time cannot be considered when determining charitable contributions. Currently, the bill is limited to medical professionals, dentists, or chiropractors. This bill would treat these professions differently than other careers such as CEOs, lawyers, CPAs, servers, construction workers, or custodial services. If this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with the Chair, Representative Grunhagen, and staff. We thank you for the opportunity to be a resource today, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Any questions for Mr. Cummings?
Yeah.
Any questions for Representative Grunhagen? Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen, in your opening statement introducing your bill, you mentioned that this is something that the insurance agencies and agents were looking forward to for quite some time. Is that the case in this new bill now that you just...
No, I should have... Representative McDonald, which opening statement were we referring to?
His first one on the wrong bill that he was introducing.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McDonald, I misspoke. It should have been an emphasis on medical professionals, okay, rather than insurance.
Vice Chair McDonald.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. So even more important, the medical industry than insurance agents. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Good.
Any other questions? Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I'd be interested if the author would be willing to comment about the point that the department made, is that, you know, about other professions that help with what I would define then as charitable services. A lawyer, an accountant that perhaps helps people with their income taxes and what have you. We see, you know, volunteers doing a lot of work in those areas, so I'd be interested in your comment relative to that point, being that your bill deals with just health care, as important as that is, those other services are probably very vital to a lot of people as well.
Representative Grunhagen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that question, Representative Carlson.
The concept for this bill was initiated because of a constituent of mine and also talking to medical professionals in my district. I had a constituent who was having lots of teeth problems, and he could not get in to see a dentist, and he'd get infections in his gums, and his face would swell up almost on the one side, almost twice its normal size. So he was constantly running up on a pretty regular basis to the emergency room at the hospital to address this. And as anybody knows, when you get an infection in that area that swells up, it can go to your brain and kill you. Well, in talking with some of the dental providers in my area, especially the dentist that works on me, and my sister also works for a dentist, I just said, would it help that you would, and he didn't have any coverage, this particular constituent. He had some money coming in from being disabled, but it wasn't just enough to cover his rent and his immediate expenses. So I basically, in talking to the dental professionals, they said if there was some type of a tax incentive to see people for charitable care, it would incentivize them to do more. But I finally was able to get him into a dentist to get that corrected, but it did take me a while in order to get him in there. And to this day now, he hasn't been going back to the emergency room in the hospital.
Yeah, sure. Chairman, that really wasn't my question. I said as important as health care is. The question that I posed was the department's comments about other professions outside of medical care that also perform various pro bono or charitable kinds of services, and he mentioned specifically the law profession, and I think you mentioned accountants that might help with, we're in tax season now with taxes and so on. If you had given any consideration or thought to those other professions that devote time and energy to help people that are in need. So that was the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, that was the second part of my answer. So I don't see those other areas that were alluded to by Mr. Cummings as being life-threatening situations, such as my constituent. So when you're dealing with health care, and especially the deferral of treatment for health care, we all know that the sooner a health condition is treated, the quicker that it can be resolved. And if it's not treated and it's deferred, the worse it can get over a period of time. So when I look at the other areas that he referenced, I don't see that they're life-threatening type situations, hence the incentive to address the health care issue.
Mr. Chairman, I think the short answer then was no in terms of other professions.
I can add the word no.
Representative Grunhagen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's correct, Representative Carlson. Any other questions? Okay, with that, Representative Grunhagen renews his motion to House File 156 as amended, be later for possible inclusion in the upcoming awesome tax bill. Item next, Representative Thiessen. And I apologize for going out of order here, but we needed to accommodate some folks. So thank you, Representative Thiessen. If you could, I will move House File 816. Members, are there any amendments? Okay. We have 816 before us. Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill basically sets up in Minnesota automatic federal conformity each year. It would set up a fund of $20 million that then, once we leave session and Congress acts on certain pieces that we would need to later conform to, the Department of Revenue could just go ahead and do that administratively. What the bill would say is when we come back into session, that would be topped off again, back up to the $20 million. You know, these are the first thing I want to say is, you know, this is all tax reductions for Minnesotans. You know, so when we do this conformity, it's all reducing people's taxes. But as many of you know and who have been through this before, it creates, when we're delayed after Congress, you know, acts and then, you know, we need to conform or not, it creates a lot of administrative complexity, challenges for taxpayers who have to, you know, file amended returns, and lots of challenges for tax preparers as well. It's kind of as simple as these things can be, but I do have a couple testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. First of all, to see where we're at, I have Mr. Egger, and then we have the witness before us. Is there anyone else wish to testify on behalf of this bill? Anyone with concerns? Department? Department will be up after we've had our witnesses. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Ruth Ann McNay. I'm representing the Minnesota CPA Society.
Welcome to the committee.
You're welcome. And I have a small CPA firm on the east side of St. Paul. I call it Main Street, Minnesota. I do about 200 to 250 returns, and I meet with every one of my clients except those who have moved, and we do it by phone. I deal with individuals and small businesses, LLCs, S-Corps, C-Corps, and partnerships. My individuals are from a small family, a single parent. It deals with EIC to additional child tax credit all the way up to grandma and grandpa, probably over a half a million of income, so it ranges the whole gamut. As I said, it's Main Street, Minnesota. And I deal with the small businesses, with startups. We're trying to do planning with them, and probably the top tier of my businesses are about $1.5 to $2 million. And they're the ones that are hiring people, and that's really exciting. And so during my time in my own business, I have about 30 years of tax and accounting experience and about 13 in this business as my own firm. I did experience where we had to stop e-filing from Minnesota at the end of March a few years ago, and that was devastating. I hear the grumbling from your constituents when that happens. I also had to deal with the cases in 2015 where we couldn't file the returns, and we could file the returns, but we had to add back all this money. And that was indeed grumbling from your constituents in Minnesota. And so this bill would streamline that. And Minnesota CPA Society wants federal conformity to provide that stability and certainty to the businesses and clients that we represent, that you represent, that you have that. This would reduce the state's enforcement burden. It would reduce the client's compliance burden. It would reduce the Department of Revenue costs. When I had to share with the clients, you're going to get an $8 check from Minnesota when they correct it. Think of the expense that Minnesota Revenue went through for that. And they also got some interest. And I think that money hasn't come yet. I think it will come this fall. So, again, all of this would help with with eliminating that complexity, keeping our taxpayers happy as much as we can with the grumbling. And so with that, I would endorse support of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for the witness, Representative McDonald, or is it for the author?
It's for the author.
Okay, we'll wait. No, we'll wait a little bit. Please come forward. And if you state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Egger, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Thiessen, for bringing this bill forward, Mr. Chair, for scheduling the bill. And also, just again, thank you to the committee and the legislature for passing early federal conformity this session. We appreciate the issue that this bill is trying to address, which the CPAs have done a nice job of highlighting. And basically, the one word I would use is the uncertainty that's created when there's a significant time gap between when the federal government passes the tax extenders package and when Minnesota is able to conform. And our realtor members, and I've been before this committee describing the situation in the past, the most common situation that our members face is when they're working with a homeowner who's contemplating whether to move ahead with a short sale. Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, the number of short sales in the state is significantly lower today. It's about 7% compared to where we were just 5-6 years ago, where it was upward of a third to 40%, even higher in some areas of the state. So we do support moving forward with some mechanism for having automatic conformity when the federal government passes that tax extenders package. And we also want to thank Representative Sarah Anderson, Representative Hurtaz, Representative Marquardt, and Representative Dabney for signing onto a bill that was introduced yesterday that addresses the two home ownership provisions that are part of the federal conformity package, and hope to have a hearing at some point this session on that bill. And with that, I just like to communicate our support for this legislation or some variation of it so that we can address federal conformity in a more automatic nature than we have in the past. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Question, Representative Hurtaz and then Carlson to Mr. Eggers. Representative Hurtaz?
To the author.
Oh, to the author. Oh,
to the author.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Egger? Okay, thank you to the CPAs and the realtors. Appreciate it. And now let's go to the department, and then we'll have the author come back. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I was able to reach out to Representative Thiessen before the hearing today. This bill establishes an ongoing administrative method to conform to Minnesota's individual income tax and corporate franchise tax laws to extensions of existing federal tax benefits that Congress enacts after the legislature adjourns its regular session and then apply that tax to that tax year. Providing for a pre-conformity account would increase stability and predictability for taxpayers impacted by provisions in the federal update. Most years, federal tax legislation is passed after the Minnesota legislature has concluded for the year. Typically, one of the first orders of business when reconvening the following year is to pass a conformity bill that realigns Minnesota with federal tax law. We would like to thank you, Mr. Chair, for taking a leadership role in passing the federal update within the first 2 weeks of 2017. Since tax forms and information are prepared well in advance of the legislature passing a conformity bill, the forms, instructions, and tax information the Department of Revenue prepares are out of date when conformity passes and have to be revised in order for taxpayers to file accurate returns. This complication presents delays for both the department and the taxpayers waiting their refund. We were able to make that work this year because we planned for both scenarios and because the bill was passed in advance of the opening of filing season. If the legislature is called into session in late January, February, or even March, this could mean that Minnesota's forms would be non-conforming with the federal tax code for that filing season. This bill will likely reduce complexity for tax filing for all Minnesotans and give them more certainty when planning and filing their taxes. We would like to thank Representative Thiessen for bringing this bill forward. I would also like to thank Ms. Manzi and Mr. Michael for their thoughtful approach in preparing these drafts. We do think this bill is administrable. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be a resource today. We look forward to continuing the conversation with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, other members, and staff as this bill works its way through the session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Mr. Cummings. And maybe to Mr. Michael or Mr. Cummings, either of you, I really like what this bill is trying to do here. And the one question, because I cannot remember a session where we didn't come in and say we need to get conformity, to do it fast, right? And it's always, can you think of one, Mr. Cummings?
Well, Mr. Chair, there was last year. There was 2014. 2014 conformity passed in late March.
Which, yeah, when you have the second year of the biennium, it gets kind of tough. Right. Maybe to Mr. Michael, as I was reading this, my one thought was the only concern I would have with this is, let's say somebody elected president like Donald Trump, and let's say that there were major, major tax changes, but I guess you have a safety valve in here with $20 million, then you list out what it goes to first, so I guess that would kind of take care of some concerns that might happen there. Representative Thiessen?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, it's capped at 20. I mean, it could never be more than $20 million, and then the bill sets up, and Mr. Michael can speak more to this, but it sets up the priority. You know, so if the the things listed are more than $20 million, the bill actually also prioritizes, so it would never go over that amount.
So you would get certain things done up to the 20. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill essentially only allows conformity with what is generally referred to as the tax extenders. So if Congress, in its wisdom, enacts some broad tax changes that go beyond that, the legislature will just have to address that. And part of the problem with this is that the Minnesota Supreme Court has said the legislature cannot sort of delegate to Congress decisions about the tax base if it's not something that's very clear and very constrained. So in the past, in the 1960s, the legislature just said, well, we'll follow whatever Congress does. And then the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that when Congress, you know, made a significant change that the legislature had not endorsed. But in this case, because we know exactly what those provisions are, it's, you know, you're expressing very clear legislative direction as to what's to be conformed to. And so that's the problem with sort of a major Trumpian tax change that, you know, we just don't know what it'll be.
Okay, to the department.
No.
Person Marker, to the author. Okay. Any questions for Mr. Cummings? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Cummings. We will now go to questions to the author. I have McDonald, Hertas, Carlson, and Marquardt. Anyone else? Okay, and you can jump in here if you want to. Vice Chair McDonald, to the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen, yeah, on just the surface, it looks like a very good idea and something that I probably can get behind. And just questions, just reading some of the House research, in the Department of Revenue will determine, the commissioner will determine the priorities as to first, second, third, and so on and so forth. The priorities that are listed, is that, are those set in stone, if you will, or does the commission determine, you know what, maybe priority number two should go overcome priority number three, or et cetera, et cetera?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the legislation lays it out pretty clearly and constrains the department in terms of their priorities. And really it's aimed at minimizing complexity for taxpayers. So the first priorities are items that have a very small cost, but it would require a taxpayer to, you know, recompute their adjusted gross incomes, kind of the pain in the ass things, excuse me. And then it has to do with timing issues like depreciation, et cetera, and then it goes to the next set. Within those priorities, you know, I think it also says it has to go in order of the way they're listed in the bill. So it puts some pretty severe constraints around the department's like flexibility in switching things around.
Vice Chair McDonald.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. And then in the odd case that somehow we wouldn't want to conform with federal conformity for some odd reason, I can't think of any in history that we wouldn't, but is there any safety nets or setbacks, clawbacks that the legislature can then decide to change perhaps at the time, or is it too late by that time if we meet in March?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would probably be too late for that year. You know, we could always act. I suppose we could act a clawback, although I can't ever imagine us doing that. So it would, it would go into effect. It would be as if we had passed it for that year.
Chair McDonald.
Thank you. Thank you. Lastly, then, and it's just 1 year, if I read the bill correctly, for the 2018-19. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, this is permanent. So, but it would be one year at a time. But you know, so if they spent, you know, $10 million to conform for 2018, we would then put $10 million back into the fund for the next year. So it's an ongoing thing. We conform every year, but the department can only act 1 year at a time. So to your earlier question, if at some point we decide this particular extender doesn't make sense, we could certainly change the law to take that out of the list so the department couldn't do that in the future. And, you know, these extenders just, you know, and I didn't know this, but probably all of you do. I mean, these are things that Congress literally does every year, but they don't make them permanent because they have budget rules in Congress, so they don't, you know, it's like tails, right, as I understand it, that they don't want to, you know, if they make them permanent, the cost is significantly more. So they're pretty regular. I mean, I think they're always regular and routine things that Congress does every year, and we usually, when we get a tax conformity bill done, pass every year.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Vice Chair. McDonald.
Well, thank you.
Let's go to Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Thiessen, this seems like a pretty logical and sensible thing to do. A couple questions I have, though. I would the administrative ruling give authority in a bidirectional way if Congress removed certain deductions, that the administration would also remove those deductions for state taxpayers that previously were there? Why don't you start with that one?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would say right now there is no state tax deductions for these unless we act every year. So if Congress decided not to do one extender, the commissioner wouldn't do that extender, but there'd be nothing to conform to. So we wouldn't be, like, increasing taxes. We just wouldn't do that one for that year, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Thiessen, so I'm a little curious if you could expand a little bit why we need to actually appropriate money for this. Couldn't we just deal with this relatively small amount of money, given the size of our general fund, to deal with it out of reserves or a cash flow account? I mean, with regard to implementation, it would affect the budget, but we could draw it out of reserves like we have any other rainy day fund, and then certainly deal with it in the next budget cycle, knowing that this is reduced revenue in our budget cycle.
Representative Thiessen?
So the way it works, it just sets up an account within the general fund. So in some sense, we're not, you know, it's kind of an accounting issue more than anything. And there are times when, you know, we don't have reserves in Minnesota. And I've been here when those times have been here. So I don't know if Mr. Michael or anybody else has any thoughts on that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hertas, there's nothing that would prevent you from enacting it without setting aside money to pay for it. It's just a question of whether you want to do that as sort of a budgeting prudential matter or not.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my last question, if arbitrarily we just pick a number of $20 million and let's say the benefit as it applies to Minnesota might cost $24 million, does 80% of applicants get cut off at the $20 million and they don't get to enjoy the benefit? Or what type of stopgap do we have in a circumstance like that to assure equal protection for taxpayers?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill limits the department to conforming to note that to tax extenders that would be worth no more than $20 million. And that's what the prioritization rules in here do. So if it were $24 million, they would just not get to the last. We wouldn't conform to, you know, the last set of extenders.
Okay. Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Chair Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, by way of background, I got an identical bill yesterday from my state senator, Ann Rest.
Okay.
So I've been very interested in the discussion. And I was going to call her today. As you know, we talked about it at the beginning of the meeting. That was when I realized that we had some duplication here. But I was going to call her today and ask her how the number $20 million was chosen, because she also has in her bill that I agreed to introduce $20 million. And I was just curious, and maybe this would have been a question for the department, but how did we arrive at $20 million? And it is somewhat similar to what Representative Hertas was asking. I wasn't meaning that what happens if you go beyond, but how we arrived at $20
million. Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We put this in the last. I have, frankly, no idea.
Mr. Michael, I guess my question before that kind of on this would be, what did the conformity this year cost? Mr. Michael. To the Carlson question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the $20 million number was arrived at last year based on estimates of what the typical package of the extenders would cost. And so the general idea was that that would be enough to cover this, in a typical year, this list. Now, the thing that complicates it in the past, Section 179, which actually works out the way it is as a revenue raiser in the past, tended to offset some of the cost. And so the total cost typically was about $18 million, but now that Section 179 is permanent, I just talked to Paul Wilson in the Department of Revenue, and he said that the very last item on this list might not be coverable by this because of that. It may actually be now like $21 million or something like that. So, but the $20 million was a rough number of what it typically costs to cover this list of extenders.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then sure. Apparently there is some history with the $20 million that I wasn't aware of when she sent the bill over and I agreed to throw it in the hopper. So appreciate that, and maybe further discussions if this ends up being in the bill that we ultimately report out of committee. And I think there seems to be rather broad-based support for the bill. So maybe that number can be adjusted then to reflect what the most recent estimates are, which seem to be maybe $21 or $22 million or something like that. But thank you.
Representative Lee Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Thiessen, or maybe Mr. Michael, there's 13 clauses that kind of list the hierarchy of those extenders that would be granted. How was that list determined? I know it's things we typically do, but even among the rankings, how did that come about?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the first thing is that the priorities actually don't go necessarily in the order of these rankings. Like the bottom ones go first and then they skip to the top if you go to a different section. But I would leave it to Mr. Michael here to explain. It may have just how they show up in the tax code.
Mr. Michael, why did you do it this way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, I think the priorities were set, again, Representative Thiessen did a great job, I thought, of explaining those buckets of priorities were set based on consultation with the Department of Revenue and sort of common sense. The idea was the low-cost ones that have a lot of complexity were at the very top, and that's the ones that affect computation of AGI. So, for example, you know, that there are very small effects on AGI of some of these provisions, and that flows through to everything, including the property tax refund. And so the department felt that's the first thing you want to do because the complexity cost is high and the revenue cost is low. Then the next bucket of things were these timing things like depreciation rules. And again, that's the sort of thing that if you don't conform, taxpayers would have to keep two separate sets of books. And then the final thing was the you know, just the current year deductions. And in general, we tend to order them by the lowest cost typically being the highest so that you can do the most things that affect the most people.
Lead Marquardt.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Michael, Representative Thiessen, for that. You know, I like this. I think this creates a lot of certainty for taxpayers in terms of kind of timing when we come back and also a political climate. So we know this year that President Trump and the administration is going to be making some changes, and they're looking at deductions and tax expenditures and all those type of things, and we may not come back till February or March next year, for one thing. And then, of course, this year we're blessed with a wonderful chair and a wonderful DFL lead, who little humor there, except for the remarks towards the chair.
But I just facts.
Yeah, yes, yeah. That, you know, we get along and so forth. But if for some reason that wasn't the case, and you know, you couldn't even get a bill, this actually assures taxpayers about $20 million of tax relief. Assures them that without having to go through any political uncertainties. And yet I see if it kind of goes past and some of Representative Hurtas's questions too. So I'm wondering, just there might be, you know, some weaknesses with this, but I think in general I think it's pretty sound, and I don't, it'd be nice to try to kind of make this work if we could. But thank you.
Thank you, Lead Marquardt. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm wondering, probably Mr. Michael's the person to answer this, is I wonder to what degree we'd still need to do a conformity bill in a typical year. I'm thinking of, like, the deduction for school supplies for teachers, which I think every year I've been on this committee we've had to pass as part of the conformity, and I don't see that on the list. And so are there typically things that we would, once we reconvened, we'd have to, even if this was in a place, we would still have to consider, we'd obviously have to consider any new deductions or any major changes in the tax code at the federal level, because this is just existing as I understand it. But are there others that you would think, Mr. Michael, in a normal year where there isn't a big federal tax change, that we'd still do some, need to do some legislation or consider it when we came back?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, this, first of all, on the teacher expenses, Congress actually did the right thing and made that permanent, along with a few other things. So that's why it's not on the list. This otherwise is a list of all of the tax extenders that the legislature typically has conformed to. Obviously, and this is only for 1 year, so it's for the year when it's when Congress changes the rules during the tax year that it affects it. So you will need to act if Congress extends it for 2 years or if it makes it permanent, as it did, for example, with Section 179 and with the teacher expenses and a handful of other things. You will need to then permanently conform to those changes. And Congress always, in its wisdom, does a few things retroactively, and you're going to have to conform to those things. So it's not, we still may need to enact an early conformity bill, because almost every, as Ms. Manzi can probably attest to, almost every year there's a few other things that they throw in that apply to that back tax year. If it's just, you know, IRAs for airline employees or something like that, guaranteed they'll do that. But it's not going to affect probably many taxpayers. And so, you know, 99% of the taxpayers won't be affected.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's really helpful. And Representative Thiessen, I was wondering, I'm always a little hesitant to totally delegate to the administration, even though I know they do a really good job. And so I'm wondering if you might be open to considering, like, in establishing the priorities, that the commissioner shall consult with the chairs of the tax committee or something like that, so it's more of a partnership decision in reviewing the priorities. It's hard to anticipate ahead of time what, but how that might work out, but I just think it's a nice step of partnership and to think about.
Representative
Thiessen? Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So anything else, Representative Loeffler? Okay. Okay. Just Mr. Michael or Ms. Manzi, if the Thiessen bill was enforced 10 years ago, would we have had many situations that Representative Loeffler is referring to, or would it pretty much covered things over the last 10 years, let's say? Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, I think that, you know, the number of extenders has accordioned over time, but I think if a mechanism like this had been in effect, it would have saved, you know, there have been a number of years where you would not have had the M1NC, you know, the nonconformity provision. And the one thing I will say with regard to Representative Loeffler's point, the department really has very little discretion under this. Though the priorities are set in the statute, the discretion they have involves estimating the cost of it and determining whether they can move down the list as specified in the statute, and at what point do they no longer have enough money to conform. So if they were going to consult with the legislature, it would be consulting about the quality of the estimating, which we've, you know, generally not done.
Thank you, Mr. Michael. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Thiessen, for bringing the bill. At least on the face of it, it looks practically like it's attractive. The only question I have is, are we ceding our authority as a legislature in the face of the Constitution by doing this? Are there any constitutional considerations? And Representative Thiessen, have you thought about that at all or considered it?
Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, part of the reason, first of all, that there's this Subdivision 1 in here, which is a statement of purpose and all of that, I think, which is, I usually don't, are usually not included in bills, but I think it is to go to that issue because there is the Supreme Court case and there is some delegation issue here. But I would say this bill is pretty tightly drafted so that we're not leaving, we're really not leaving the department with much discretion to do anything. It's as if we're, you know, we're directing them. It's essentially doing the same thing we would do if we came in and passed a tax conformity bill early in session. It's just so tightly constrained. I don't think we're giving up much authority as a legislature. And, you know, of course, if we feel like in the future that some extender is not one we want to go ahead with, you know, we can always take that out of those lists. So what I guess the short way of saying this, I just think this bill is so tightly drafted that the only discretion, as Mr. Michael said, the only discretion the department has is in the estimate of how much it's going to cost the state, and that's discretion we give the department today anyway.
Chair Jaskowski?
No further questions. Thank you.
Any other questions for the author? Okay, I will renew my motion, and thank you very much for some peace in this, and thank you, members, for a very good discussion here. I will renew my motion.
Can I just say one more
thing? Oh, sorry. Please wrap up.
The only other thing I would say for the House is, just in my experience, we have to originate bills, tax bills. It gives the Senate, when we have to do these conformity bills, as you probably know from experience, lots of leverage over us. So I actually think doing this way takes away some leverage from the Senate in their negotiation in the future, too. So.
And, President Thiessen, that's a good thing. And like I say, too much of a good thing is a good thing. Thank you. I'll renew my motion to House File 816 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Representative Thiessen. Item next, Representative Johnson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Johnson. I will move House File 16 so that we have it before us. And we have, I believe, a Peggy Moon, Todd Kemmery, and Jim Dolan. Is that correct? Or minus Representative Johnson.
To that question, Mr. Chair, we have Mr. Kemmery here and Mr. Diamond, a couple of veterans, too. Provide testimony as needed.
Okay. What was the gentleman's name to your left?
Diamond. Tom Diamond.
Tom Diamond. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so members, we have House File 16. I will move that. I see no amendments to your bill. Chairman Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The purpose of this bill, members, is to extend a current income tax credit to more veterans, in particular low-income and disabled veterans. Currently, Minnesota provides an income tax credit up to $750 to veterans who have served at least 20 years or who have a service-connected disability of 100%. And current law phases out this credit at a rate of 10% when the adjusted gross income equals $30,000, with no credit for incomes $37,500 or higher. Now, this tax credit was enacted in 2008. What this bill does then, members, is increase the income level at which the credit phase out begins from $30,000 to $50,000, with no credit allowed for incomes of $57,500 or higher. And this also, it expands the eligibility by extending credit to all disabled veterans who have a compensable service-connected disability. And Mr. Chair, as you might remember, this bill was in the final omnibus tax bill that was agreed to in conference committee tax bill last year. The language was slightly different, but this bill was present therein. And I have two testifiers, as noted, to speak to the bill. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. Before we start the testimony, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill, House File 16? Anyone with concerns? The department? Not on this one? Okay, so please state your name, who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Todd Kemmery. I'm the Vice President of the Minnesota Chapter Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair. As a service-connected veteran, 100% catastrophically disabled, as the VA has labeled me, I receive quite a bit, a few benefits. But I'm here on behalf of my fellow veterans, for those that have, how should I put it, any category that is less than 100%. And what I'd like to do is to maybe shed some light on how that works as far as financial. 2010, 2011, there was zero cost of living adjustment. Last year was a zero cost of living adjustment. This year, it's a fraction. It's not even half of a percent. It's 0.3% of an increase. In my Marine Corps math, for every $100, 0.3 represents basically $3. Actually, less than that. So, what I'd like to stress is this, is that for those of us that are on a fixed income, these are things that can help with the House Rainy Day Fund, if you will. And this includes a larger group of veterans here in the state of Minnesota to benefit on some of the ease of that from day-to-day cost of living. I think what I'm poorly getting to, and people are much more articulate on this than I am, but from a personal and from a level that that represents a lot of people that are very vulnerable, this adds just a little bit of better quality of life. And the state of Minnesota has been wonderful to its veterans, and the veterans organizations that are here and established in the state of Minnesota, we would like to be able to keep our veterans here in the state of Minnesota well past retirement. And this is just one of those small extras, a measure that would help with that ultimate goal of providing a little bit something extra for our veterans, plus keeping our veterans here in the state of Minnesota. And with that, I'll conclude, and thank you for this opportunity, Chair and Representatives.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Kemmery? Okay, let's go to the next witness. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Sure. John Diamond, DFL Veterans Caucus. I just wanted to comment quickly on the fiscal note. The fiscal note does not completely define what the cost would be, but it sets a $60 million number. And while it would be wonderful if we could get that kind of assistance for our disabled veterans, this is a much more modest bill. And just to clarify, that number is based upon all the compensably disabled veterans being eligible for this credit. This does not go that far. It would be wonderful if we could get there. This bill does two things. It extends the current credit from 100% to all currently or all compensable disabled veterans. That's a $30,000 cap for full credit now. And then the second thing it does is it raises that limit modestly to $50,000. Just to give you an idea of the difference that this makes, that $60 million figure is based on all 90,000 disabled veterans being eligible. Currently, in the 100% pool, it's roughly at that pool is 10,000 disabled veterans. Of that, only 2,100 actually receive the benefit. So roughly 2 in 10 currently receive the benefit. Now, mind you, we are asking for that modest increase from 30,000 to 50,000. So there's going to be an increase, but it's not going to be 100%. It's not going to be that number. It's going to be some number slightly more than 2 in 10 that would be eligible, but for the pool. And so I think it's important to take a look at it. There's another figure in here, and I'm going to take the chair's word that it's going to be an awesome bill that comes out of here. and hopefully we'll be able to get all the, at least this modest benefit to the, that narrow segment of all the, all percentage of the disabled veterans. But there's also an important point in here. It points out that of the pool, roughly half of them are in the 10 to 20% disabled veterans. So if one has to limit who gets this, if you limited it to 30% in greater disability, you would reduce whatever that number is by one half. Again, I'm not advocating for it, but what I'm just trying to point out is that we can extend the benefit to a larger number or greater number of the percentages of disabled veterans and increase the amount while still keeping it at a figure that's significantly less than that number that's in there, so people's eyes pop out when they see that. They know that that's not what the really the request is here. I'd be glad to stand for your questions.
Thank you. Chair Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author, Mr. Representative Johnson. What part of the language in this bill was not in the language in the 2016 tax omnibus bill?
Chair Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I'll just read you what the language said in the bill that was in the tax conference bill last year, and that stated that the bill increases the credit for past military service from $750 to $1,000 and increased the income level at which the credit begins to phase out from $30,000 to $50,000 with full phase out at $60,000. So that's the language that was in the tax conference bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and that's the I know you and I had discussions, and we felt that that was something we should be definitely going forward with, and that language did appear in the conference committee. And I know Ms. Mansi spent a lot of time in this subject, veterans pensions and this types of legislation. Ms. Mansi, could you explain what we did last year in terms of the pension and also with this the current legislation, and if we did pass this legislation in terms of the options that veterans have?
Ms. Mansi?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, the conference committee report, as Representative Johnson read, contained a portion of what's in House File 16, but a modified version. House File 16 would extend the income at which the credit begins to phase out from $30,000 to $50,000, which was in the conference report. The conference report also increased the credit from $750 to $1,000, which resulted in the phase-out extending to $60,000 instead of the $57,500 as in House File 16. The conference committee report did not include the extension of the credit to all veterans who had any compensable disability rating, but continued to limit it to those who had a 100% disability rating. Now, the supplemental appropriations bill included a new income tax subtraction for military retirement pay, and it included language, as we discussed in your committee, I think last week, that provided the intent that a person would claim the subtraction or the credit, but not both. And I think there'll be some language on that topic in the department's technical or policy bill when those bills come before the committee to clarify that. And the estimate for this bill assumes continuation of that approach where a veteran would claim either the subtraction for military retirement pay or the credit, but not both. Now, the difference between the two is that they serve two different populations. Is the subtraction is limited to those who receive a pension from the military, and it pretty much is everyone who receives a pension from the military for service in the military, including survivors. The credit, however, is available to people who either served at least 20 years in the military or had the 100% compensable disability rating. Now, someone who served 20 years in the military is most likely going to receive a pension. I'm not going to assert that everyone does, but they most likely are going to receive a pension. The people who have the disability rating of 100% are most likely receiving disability pay, which is non-taxable. rather than receiving a pension. So under the credit, if you have the 100% disability rating, you're going to get that if you're income eligible, but you aren't going to benefit from the new subtraction that was enacted in the appropriations bill.
Thank you, Chair. And Ms. Mancy, I know you've spent a lot of time in these types of legislation and coming in. And when I came into the legislature, it was something that was dear to my heart that we were going to be doing something for veterans. Mr. Diamond points out a fact that, even though the bill states that this would kick in at, the credit would kick in at 10%, but we're looking at this as we get this bill going forward, we can adjust that and make sure that, because you're looking at possible 89,500 disabled veterans that have some type of disability, that could be $680 million. So that's something that we got to look at and see where this will fit into things. So, but we did have that first part of the bill in the conference committee last year. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Chair Detmer. Representative Chair Carlson and then Loeffler.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Looking at the revenue note, it says the last year that information was available was 2013, but it says 10,000 veterans were eligible for the credit and only 2,100 actually claimed it. And I was wondering if anybody has an answer to the question as to why so many didn't claim it, because it says they were eligible, so there must be some reason they fill out the short form, or maybe Mr. Representative Detmer knows.
Chair Detmer?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think sometimes it could be a number of reasons. Maybe they just didn't know about the credit, or they decided, I don't want to be filling out paperwork, and I've got an income where I'm on the certain level, and I might not qualify. So there could be a lot of different reasons why a person wouldn't fill out the paperwork.
A follow up. When I read that, I was wondering, and you've covered part of it, that maybe they're not aware of the credit and what is being done through the veterans' organizations or revenue to make sure the veterans are informed that that benefit is there. Being that, it looks like about 80% of them aren't claiming it.
Mr. Diamond, to that point?
Mr. Chair, more work needs to be done on information, but I think an important piece of that is to follow up on Representative Detmer. Is what that's talking about is not really eligibility. It states that it's eligibility, but what it is talking about, the pool, there's roughly 10,000 100% disabled veterans, part of that 90,000. They're not actually all eligible, because there's a 30,000 cap to get the full benefit and 37.5 to get any benefit. It's also not a refundable credit. So those who are low income don't get it either, because they fall off because they're either not filing for taxes or they don't have the tax payment to get the credit on. So that's why I say these numbers are actually, of who truly is eligible, is a smaller number than is portrayed in this presentation. And so it's important to take that into consideration.
Mr. Chen, that's a good explanation then, because as I was reading that, I assumed that there were 10,000 eligible that simply weren't claiming it, and you're saying that the 10,000 number is really not accurate under current law then.
Mr. Diamond.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad Mr. Diamond called our attention to the unknown being potentially as much as $61 million in terms of by changing the disability threshold. And I do think when we first passed this, the 100% disability was really a recognition that someone's career opportunities and life opportunities had been severely impacted by their service. And I have some concern about dropping it down to 10% when we're told by the fiscal note that most of those people are working full-time. They've moved on. I'm not sure what the levels are, how they determine it. I did have I mean, we've all interacted with a variety of disabled vets, people who've come back from Iraq with traumatic brain injuries, with lack of short-term memory. Their career options are very limited, even though they're physically fine. They're not able to sustain employment in any expectation. And yet, I also am aware of a constituent from an older war who was 100% disabled because of being found diabetic, and had a long career in the post office, an active career as a carrier, and, you know, that doesn't fit the stereotype either. And so I think as we set this disability level, I think we might want to think about, you know, what is a reasonable level to recognize someone whose life options have been radically changed, and, you know, targeting it to those who are of lesser income. Really, that's probably because they're not able to function at the level that would earn a really high income because of the limitations that they've had to endure. So I would just really encourage us to continue to look at this, and if there's a way to get some better information about what the levels mean and what the likelihood is of, you know, career complications and those sorts of things, that might be helpful in helping us decide what's the appropriate percent.
Any other questions from members? Chair Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, with the reference to the 10%, we had a distant relative that had a severe head injury during World War II, and the family had great difficulty getting him to go in periodically for a checkup, and when he didn't go in, he started with a high disability rating, and then they would drop it down. I don't know if they still do that today. And then finally his family would get him to go into the Veterans Administration, and then it would be adjusted upwards again. Now, he was an individual. His parents owned an apartment building, and he had one of the apartments there, and his parents, it was very severe, kind of looked out for him. But they did have that rule in the Veterans Administration where he was periodically supposed to go in, and then when he didn't, because he was difficult in that regard to deal with, they would drop that disability down. So do they still do that today, and is that a possible reason that people could have a lower disability number?
Mr. Kemmery?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I personally have an annual every year. That's something that the spinal cord injury team and the rehab center does at the VA Medical Center. Each one of our veterans are allowed or afforded the ability to go on and have their checkups, but to arbitrarily have somebody make a decision, well, he's better now than he was last year, there is a process that the VA has to go through, and there are checks and balances in place that doesn't prevent that from just happening overnight. I guess what I'm probably getting to is what used to be for some individuals and the way things that were done. The veteran service organizations and the service officers that are out there now are very skilled and very good at being able to prevent something as tragic as that has happened. So I guess the short answer would be no, the VA can't just reduce something without having to go through an appeals process.
Mr. Chairman, you're saying that my understanding, at one time they could have, or they did.
Those are maybe some of the horror stories.
And he was a World War II vet, you know, that I'm talking about, Mr. Chairman. So, I do know that it would go a long period of time, and the family, for whatever reason, he just didn't want to go in for a checkup. And he never worked after the war. You know, he relied very heavily on that disability.
Sure.
And fortunately, his parents provided him with a living arrangement and so on. But he would be dropped down until they could get him to go out to the veterans. So I'll just stop there. I was curious if that was still done, and if that would be the reason. I was kind of following up on Representative Loeffler's point about the 10% and those lower ratings. But
Mr. Diamond, very briefly.
Yes, I think there are some cases where they can do that, but I think to the point is that's why there's also an income cap on here. It limits those, the finances of an individual who would be eligible, which I think gets to some of what Representative Loeffler was, that you would, if you had a good income, a high income, you would not be eligible for this credit.
Any other questions for the author or the testifiers? I'm going to wrap her up there, Chair Johnson.
It's a good goal, Mr. Chair. Thank you and the committee for your time.
I renew my motion that House File 16 be there for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Chair Johnson. Item next, we have House File 869 on Metsa bill. Representative Eklund will be presenting the bill.
Bless you.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Eklund. I will move House File 869. Members, are there any amendments? Seeing no amendments, we have the bill before us. Will you please present the bill? Then I have listed Mary Jo George with AARP. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on behalf of the bill with concerns thereof? The department?
Not at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Not thank you that you're not testifying, but thank you for your response. Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you for allowing me to pinch it today. This bill adjusts the income threshold for seniors exempt from paying taxes on Social Security benefits to reflect inflation by way of subtraction. Currently, for taxpayers with provisional income under $25,000 or $32,000 from married joint taxpayers, all Social Security benefits are excluded from taxable income. These income levels have not been adjusted in a number of years, and this bill essentially increases the threshold exempt income by way of tax subtraction from $55,000 for single, $71,000 for married joint filers. Specifically, the bill allows filers with provisional income under $71,000 for married joint filers or $55,000 for all others to subtract Social Security benefits in computing their Minnesota taxable income. The bill then phases out the subtraction for filers with income over that threshold, depending on how much Social Security and other income the person receives. Finally, the bill indexes the threshold for inflation. That's the basic bill, Mr. Chair, and Mary Jo George would testify on behalf of it.
Thank you. Please state your name and who represents the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with AARP Minnesota. I think Representative Eklund did a fine job of explaining what this bill does, and thank you for stepping in Representative Metz's place. As we have testified previously, we do support reducing taxes on Social Security. We think that this approach is probably the best approach to look at, since it does reduce taxes on Minnesota's people who are in the lower and moderate income. Representative Eklund had testified, these exemption levels have not been raised for 30 years, so we know more and more low and middle income Minnesotans are paying taxes on their benefits. In fact, the number of Minnesotans who are paying taxes on their Social Security benefits has more than doubled over the years, from about 160,000 in 1998 to more than 354,000 in 2013. As a result, the amount of Social Security benefits included in taxable income has quadrupled. At the same time, I think, as you heard from the previous testifier, when you're on a fixed income, many of your costs have gone up too, and it's difficult sometimes to keep up with increased costs for health care, utilities, and other basic necessities. So again, as Representative Eklund described, really today what we have is an exemption level at $25,000. We're going to raise that to $55,000 for single filers, and we're going to raise that to $72,000 for couples. It's important to note that the benefits, the Social Security benefits, became taxable in 1984. It's our understanding that these threshold amounts are resulting from 1992, which is is fine. But that at that time in 1984, the median income was about $24,000, a figure less than the exemption threshold of $25,000. Today's median income is more like $67,000, more than 2.5 times the taxation exemption threshold. Chair Davis and committee members, we are very concerned that a secure retirement is out of reach for many Minnesotans. As it stands today, many more older adults are going to be relying on Social Security as their sole source of retirement income. So at AARP, not only are we working on new retirement models for workers who lack retirement saving plans at their workplace, but we also believe reducing this Social Security tax burden is a step in the right direction. Again, I think this targeted approach makes the best sense because it does provide the relief, but will give us the revenue that we need to sustain important programs that older Minnesotans rely on. Clearly, we're here at the Capitol asking for investments in, for example, health care and long-term care. So we really would hope that we could get some bipartisan support on this legislation this year. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for members? Chair Carlson?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, a question of AARP. We have a lot of retirees that are under an approved pension plan, and I have asked this question informally, but I want to do it before the committee. And is AARP working on people who are the pensioners that would be under an approved plan, and that meant that they were not under Social Security? Because I understand what you're saying about Social Security, but there are a lot of parallels, and I think when I was talking to some of the AARP folks the other day, pointed out that at that point I just met with a group of federal retirees who have raised a very similar issue, but there would be other approved pension plans, both in the public and private sector, where they, because they're approved, are not under Social Security.
Ms. George?
Thank you. Representative Davids, Chair Davids, Representative Carlson, we absolutely would support looking at ways that we could include all retirees. We have been talking to the folks that represent the national federal employee pensioners that do not get Social Security for one reason or another. I think we do have about 94-95% of Minnesotans are eligible for Social Security, but there is a small percentage. So one of the things that we have looked into, and we'd be most interested in a friendly amendment, but we understand that we do allow for some exemptions for other retirement income today. For example, I think we allow $9,000 for single filers and $18,000 for couples, but we would be supportive of looking at whether we'd need to increase those to reflect inflationary amounts or increase the income limits that we have in law today so that more people might be eligible for that. But we absolutely have been working in partnership with folks and feel that really overall we need to look at a secure retirement for everyone. So.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I only wanted to put that on the table just so there's an understanding. I guess I was just surprised that it's only 5%, but that I'll take that as being an accurate number. I would have guessed that some number higher than that. But there is that other category of people if we want to talk about a level playing field among retirees. And I don't want to distract from the Social Security part of it, but just saying that there are other employees that, due to their work history, their employer, are not under Social Security.
Questions for members? Okay, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 869 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Eklund, for pinch-hitting. Thank you, Ms. George, for your testimony. Item last, I will move House File 622. And there is an amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. I'll move the H0622A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended before us. And members, this bill very simply continues to work on work that we did in previous years regarding the definition of residency. When it comes to basically somebody moves out of the state Then there have been some things that may try to bring them back to the state for tax purposes, and we're trying to clean some of that language up. So is there anyone who wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Anyone with concerns? The department?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, sure. It's Valentine's Day, Mr. Cummings. Welcome to committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I did call your office yesterday. I wasn't able to talk to you, Mr. Chair. At the previous hearing this year, I spoke broadly about our work over the last few years on how we've been improving our approach to the topic of residency and domicile cases, and how we work with our customers. I'm happy to talk through that again, or I'm willing to talk to more members offline. Mr. Chair, we believe that identifying the appropriate residency status of taxpayers is important for the integrity and administration of our tax system. First, we want to thank the advocates for agreeing to some common sense changes to the language in your bill, and we hope that they can be included in the final tax omnibus bill, specifically related to CPAs and other types of professional staff. You also included in your bill ensuring that determinations of domicile apply to all domicile determinations, not just to those domiciled in Minnesota, and ensuring that the effective date starts at the beginning of the tax year. We believe that those are two positive changes. We understand the issues surrounding the claims made by professionals in other states that take one or more of Minnesota Supreme Court cases out of context. Those cases do not rely only on one factor. We also, Mr. Chair, we also want to ensure that by excluding their physical presence, we're not excluding physical transactions or declarations made when conducting businesses with those people. Meaning here that we want to know what they declare when they're applying for insurance, but not necessarily who they're applying for insurance with. Second, on the issue of medical days, Mr. Chair, verifying the days spent in the state primarily for medical treatment would be challenging for the department and for the taxpayer. Excluding medical days spent in the state would lead to very personally intrusive questions during an examination process that would make auditing this criteria very difficult without infringing upon privacy issues. This bill would treat medical days unlike all other reasons for being in the state, and it would allow people to become non-residents even if they spend more than one half of the year in the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be a resource. We look forward to continuing the conversation on this and other important issues this year.
And thank you, Mr. Cummings. And the discussion will continue with the department so we can make certain this works. Representative Hertog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Cummings, thank you for your testimony. I think you've really recited the very reasons we need to get rid of all of the 26 points. Then it's not burdensome on the department at all. Just make it simple, make it clean, make it easier for people to leave this state if they want to, and maybe we'll have a better tax policy that would encourage people to stay here voluntarily. Thank you.
Questions for members? Okay, with that, I will renew my motion, House File 622, as amended, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the awesome upcoming tax bill. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you very much, members, for your work today and for last week. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.